Hi, welcome back to the Organizing Therapist. My name is Jack Register and I'm your host. This podcast is meant for therapists within the behavioral health and addictions care system to come together and talk about unifying themes and issues that we run into, and to teach some of the skills that I have learned as a macro level policy social worker in my career. In my career, I've been a clinician, I've been a practice owner, clinical director, work in hospitals, and so on. But I've also run policy positions as the state government relations director for the National Association of Social Workers in North Carolina. In North Carolina, I was also the state NAMI director, and then was in DC for a while as a contract CEO doing some national lobbying work on behalf of a healthcare group. So I have as much policy experience as I do clinical. And I started this podcast to give us therapists an opportunity to learn some of the skills that I kind of take for granted as someone who understands the public policy world a little bit better. There's a lot of conversation right now about therapists coming together and forming some sort of collective bargaining or some sort of collective group, irrespective of our particular disciplines. So this particular episode is going to be about the expectations of organizing. And I've got some fundamental sorts of things I want to talk about. The first thing is that there's a saying that has been used with me by mentors for years. You can't get oranges at a hardware store. And what this means is back in the day before we had the superstores where you could get everything everywhere, that you had to go to the right store to get the right item. In policy work, you have to go to the right level of intervention to actually figure out how to get some sort of resolution to the problem at hand. And so that might mean, for example, that if you're looking for a change in insurance statute in terms of how insurance companies do or don't fund a particular kind of service, that's an issue with the insurance company, but it's also an issue with how the state defines a particular service. Insurance companies may take the definitions that the state uses and then change those definitions into a reimbursable CPT code. The problem is, if you go to the wrong place, you're not going to get what you're looking for. The legislature can sometimes push, but then administrative rules, which are the rules that get made after law is passed, actually have to then implement what is being done. And rules administratively are usually held by some sort of Department of State government. And this becomes something that's really tough. There's an inherent power that's involved in who holds the capacity to change the rule for how something gets done. So, for example, the issues around clawbacks and whatnot. Those are insurance regulations that are within the insurance industry, within the organization itself, and may have to have legal interventions for how the insurance companies do business versus the idea of the state forcing a private insurance company to say, we're going to reimburse people on X number of days past the date of service, for example. So this power can feel really imbalanced to those of us in the field who are simply trying to figure out how do we survive as practitioners. We actually have to understand the issue that's at play within the scope of practice of how we define the issue. We as practitioners, many of us who have private practices or many of us who work within an organization, have to understand how is the reimbursement conversation happening. So, for example, if you're not the one who actually sees the CPT codes being billed, or if you're not the one who has seen the regulations for the implementation for how a particular way of billing, like incident two billing, for example, is done, or billing for associate level clinicians, then you're not necessarily going to be the person that the insurance folks want to talk to. So we have to make sure that we can speak to the issue at hand and that we're framing the issue in such a way that it is large enough and big enough for folks to actually come together and share those concerns. Much of what I see happening right now in terms of the organizing work in the mental health world for practitioners and providers is for those of us to start with our insurance questions, is to start with where are examples where we have all struggled and where can we share those examples with other people. So that's a good place for us to come together because we all have nuances of difference in terms of how our practices actually are set up based either upon discipline or based upon our level of licensing. So, for example, psychologists at the PhD level have a different scope of practice than those of us at the master's level who have our independent practice license. What is the actual issue for us? Is it about reimbursement? Is it about a concern of exploitation of associates or an exploitation of those of us who are independent, meaning the sort of corporatization of behavioral health, where we have companies who will say the expected caseload is 35 clients a week, with the expected idea that you're getting reimbursed $55 to $65 a session, right? And so the idea is we have to really understand how are we defining the issue? Is it about an increase in reimbursement only? If that's your only piece of the puzzle, then you have a particular stake in those conversations. If your conversation is really about the setup of the behavioral health system around how do I have a role in these larger organizations and how are these organizations structuring what my work is and is not, that's another part of the conversation. Some of us also see the exploitation of the next generation of associate level folks as they're coming on board and what their role even is. When I was a new practitioner back in the early 2000s, associate level folks were not even allowed to direct enroll yet. And so it's something that we have to really kind of get to the same page around. And across the country, there are different rules for different levels of licensing and different scopes of practice within particular statutes. And so part of what this podcast is going to really be about is helping to kind of put some feet to all of those conversations and to give some specificity, as well as giving some of the public policy 101 work that we would do for folks who are new to public policy work in general, as a practitioner who might be coming into a state legislature or coming into Congress to offer testimony on a bill. And my hope is that I can share with you some of the experiences that I've had, the policy clinician, and some of the ways in which my clinical side has helped and actually harmed policy work in terms of being able to be heard and be seen by other clinical folks. So those are some of the things I want to be able to talk about as we move forward. So there are some fundamental rules of organizing that are super critical. The first one is solidarity. We can't have a voice if we don't have a voice. And so that means that if my big concern might be around insurance reimbursement, but I do see the corporatization question and what is the role for practitioners within these large telehealth behavioral health practices. And I do see the exploitation of associate level clinicians, and I worry about quality supervision, and I worry about whether or not folks are seeing people in telemedicine that are inappropriate and that kind of thing. I can join the larger conversation and perhaps take a back seat to issues that are not necessarily the cornerstone of what my concern is, and then be able to focus on how I can show up in the area that I do have some expertise in. But that notion of solidarity means I'm also looking at this across discipline lines. Not one discipline is leading this movement. And so we need to be able to show that we are supporting each other. And even when there's disagreements, that we can hold space for we are all clinical folks in this together. And that our different specialties and different scopes of practice allow us to show up in the same way. Only through this solidarity are we going to have the power of the collective, which is going to be able to allow us to impact how some of these policies and regulations are showing up. Diversity. It's about all of us, or it's about none of us. The minute we start throwing groups under the bus, or we start saying that this particular kind of provider is not the same as the rest of us, then we start to have problems. This sort of movement of creating change as an organizer does not mean that we want to create change only for one part of this of the population of providers. So for my purposes in this podcast, I'm going to define a mental health provider as anyone with a credential in the behavioral health, addiction, or intellectual and developmental disability systems, since all three of those disability groups tend to be lumped together in state government. Who provide services to vulnerable populations. All of us have some form of a code of ethics through our credentialing process, whether that's a certification or a licensing. And some of that may come directly from our degree training, and some of that may come from our particular training that we have, for example, as a peer support specialist. But for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to look at providers being anyone with a credential within one of the three disability systems. The last piece, and the one that's really important, is thinking in systems. Now, I'm a social worker by training, and systemic thinking is something that we are sort of natural at because it's a core part of how we are put together. some of my colleagues in other disciplines may be able to come to this kind of thinking after they've been in practice for a while, but it may not necessarily be inherent language that is familiar from the get-go. So when we think about systemic thinking, we think about three different levels: the micro, the meso, and the macro level. All of us as practitioners live at the micro level. This is the day-to-day interactions with those who are struggling, and this is our interventions with them. The meso level might be the communities and families that are directly impacted by what's going on with our clients. And then, of course, the macro level is the big picture sorts of systems, schools and institutions, that kind of thing, that are directly impacted on a much more global level. When you move things into the world of behavioral health structure and behavioral health policy, the macro level, the highest level, is really made up of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, because these folks write service definitions. They write the definitions for how things are going to go. And whether insurance companies admit it or not, most folks in the insurance world are going to start with a template for where does Medicare go? Where does Medicare and Medicaid go in terms of payment of services? And where they go is where the rest of the insurance industry is going to go. So for example, years ago when I was first in practice, it was really common to use an adjustment disorder diagnosis for someone who was coming into care and then build slowly over time to more complex or more complicated diagnostics for somebody who may not have anything else obviously going on or for other things that have been ruled out. And this idea of using an adjustment disorder allows us to be able to start from a place that's really benign, that's not going to necessarily harm the client long-term in terms of their medical record, and is just a way for us to say, hey, this person needs support. So within the last 10 to 15 years, insurance companies and public sector, Medicare and Medicaid, have changed the way that definitions of what's getting paid for is done. So, for example, in many places, adjustment disorders are not billable anymore. They're not considered to be a part of what is considered to be an appropriate diagnosis. But this doesn't change what's clinical. What is clinical is always clinical. What is billable is always billable. The problem that we've run into is that because of the corporatization of behavioral health, what is billable becomes only what is clinical, and anything outside of that is not. And that's problematic because it means that we are allowing insurance industries to define our scope of work. So if the first step is to really understand that that is a huge conundrum that all of us live under, and that this constant sandpaper effect of what is billable versus what is clinical is out there. Many of us who've been around for a while will have stories around we've been asked by UR people or we've been asked by people within agencies to change diagnostics to something that is in line with the billing structures that are in play, and whether or not that we might or might not agree with that, and that we have to align our clinical strategy with a billing strategy. And those of us who are clinical know, and supervisors will say, that's unethical, period. There is no debate there. That's an unethical practice. So unless you can prove clinically that whatever other diagnostic is being suggested is appropriate, you're committing fraud. So there's a concern around that. And how do we live within organizations when this is being asked of us? So the next piece is that at the meso level, or sort of this community level where we might see our clients impacting the work and school and all that kind of thing of their families, within behavioral health, this is where the marketplace comes into play, because rates of reimbursement are going to be different in different markets, not because one market necessarily is quote unquote better than another, but in one case, it might be because of population density or access to higher levels of care, or there might be a particular issue that just seems to be more prevalent in one market versus another. This is a business industry decision made by insurance companies in terms of what those reimbursements look like. We also know that as practitioners, there's a difference in cost of living across the country. What works in one part of the country may be completely inappropriate in another part of the country. And so when we're asking for fair wages, looking at the idea of a consistent wage across the board may not necessarily work, because what we're getting into then is simply saying that there should be one wage for all of us, when in some cases, the process to get licensed, the process for what it costs for a master's degree, and so on, may be too expensive for folks to be able to sit in that place. So the concern is that we have to look at the market-driven price for a particular service, which might mean that we still have folks making wildly different reimbursement rates for how those particular services are going. So what we're looking at in terms of organizing is how do we answer those questions on a systemic level so that we can have some really different ways of showing up and we can have some consistent ways in which we can intervene. So in terms of the expectations of organizing, one of the strategies that I would recommend that folks use is to create what's called a therapist notebook. And a therapist notebook says, this is my kind of experiences for the day. And these are just sort of like quick comments to yourself about themes that you're beginning to see in your practice. So let's say, for example, you're an independent practitioner, you have a caseload of 25, and you're consistently seeing that it takes between 4 to 5 months to receive a reimbursement after your billing is submitted. That's a theme that we can write down. Or that you're finding that a particular CPT code is being kicked back and saying that it's an inappropriate code and they want you to move down to one where you're going from a 60-minute session to a 45-minute session as a default. And that's not in your contract. So that's when a real concern comes into play. So this sort of therapist notebook is a way for you to keep some of your particular themes at play so that you can then share them with other folks. So some key thinking here. You must make sure that you don't have identifiable information, which means that you can't necessarily identify cases. So you want to think about sort of looking at your cases from an overview point of view of sanitizing them, to the point where you can look at the big picture themes of your cases in a way that allows you to see them from an aggregate point of view. And a way to do that might simply be to keep a spreadsheet. And in this spreadsheet, you might give your clients, let's say you have 25 clients, use a letter of the alphabet for each client. And then what is the diagnosis? What is the typical CPT code that is used? What are the co-occurring issues that might be coming up? What does your referrals look like? Like this one's going to psychiatry, this one is going to a case manager, this one is going for family, and so on, however that looks in your particular practice. But again, to be able to show, these are some of the ways in which my practice is unfolding. And you could look at creating a range of this is the typical reimbursements that I might get for patient Q versus patient R, right? So that you're able to show the CPT codes might be the same, the length of sessions might be the same, diagnostics might be the same, but the reimbursements that you're getting are dramatically different. And this is where we can get into the specificity of what are different insurance companies actually reimbursing and how do those insurance companies actually show up for us. The other thing that I would say is that in this notebook is to write questions that might occur to you. So let's say you have lots of pre-existing condition, if you still had insurance plans that might be private that are still dealing with those kinds of concerns, even though the Affordable Care Act told us that that was not an issue, or you have concerns around how super bills might be showing up for folks that you have who are private pay, or what are the concerns around not being able to charge people co-pays if their particular insurance says that you can't. And there's lots and lots of education and rules and the sort of not only the business learning if you're starting a private practice on your own, but if you're going to be insurance-based, there's a whole other level of learning curve that you have to go through in order to be able to show up in the right way for how that works. So these are the sort of initial thoughts that I have for you today in terms of the expectations of organizing. As the podcast moves forward, my hope is to bring in people who are policy experts, people who are policy experts within behavioral health, and to be able to answer questions. I have a webpage up, and I actually have this podcast on the webpage, and I hope to be able to start a dialogue there. I'll be posting a link soon for how you can sign up to be a part of what we have going on with the podcast in case you want to be a speaker. My process for doing that is that folks will fill out a form, tell me a little bit about who you are and what you're up to. You and I will have a conversation together to develop some core questions so that there are no surprises in the actual interview itself. And then we will record our interview over Zoom, and then we will get you posted up onto the podcast. So I really appreciate your patience today. And my website can be found at jack-register.com. That's jack-register.com. And the last thing I'll say today is that any views expressed or any ideas expressed are mine alone and do not represent any organization to which I am affiliated, whether as a practitioner or as a member, and that I am simply sharing this as educational content. Thank you so much for your time.